Hello, my name is Ellen Robertson. I am the current WXXI Classical 91.5 intern. And today I have the pleasure of speaking with Professor Catherine Chizinski. Professor Chizinski, welcome and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Ellen. It's a lovely invitation.
So for those who may not be familiar with you and your career, you are a 2018 Grammy Award-winning mezzo-soprano who is also a master teacher teaching voice at the Eastman School of Music for the past 10 years. And you're also an advocate for music in the community in a variety of ways. Recently, your position was endowed as the Martin E. and Corazon D. Sanders Professorship of Voice, and their daughter Laura was one of your students. So with this extensive history of teaching and now your endowed professorship, I'm wondering if you could point to any particular highlights from your career or memories from your teaching that stand out as impactful or really made a difference to you or your students.
Well, that's a long story and a very, very exciting one for me. I came to teaching actually after having had a 30-year performing career, and I still continued to perform even as I started my teaching, which happened in Houston, Texas. I was at the University of Houston, and I started full-time teaching while I was still performing on a very regular basis. So this was one of those juggling acts that just sort of shifted from juggling from place to place, more or less, to juggling my current student load and jumping on a plane and getting my suitcases packed and running off to airports and parts near and far from my Houston base. And after 14 years of teaching on the faculty at the University of Houston, the opportunity to come to Eastman surfaced, and I jumped at it, and I was just overjoyed that I would have the opportunity to join this amazing faculty and to be a part of a school whose motto is for the enrichment of community life. And I was struck by that the first time I walked into the school. I met Donna Brink Fox, who is one of our chief administrators at the school. And as she took me around, she just mentioned that that's what George Eastman's vision for the founding of the school was. And I immediately took that to heart. In my time in Houston, of course, being in a major metropolitan area and having been there for over a decade as well, I had a chance to really get involved in a number of community-oriented projects. A lot of them were educational, of course, because I'm an educator at heart, and it was really one of the crux things that I discovered about performing that allowed me to be a performer. I always thought of performers naively as being very egocentric and very kind of involved in, you know, their own fame and their own artistry. And when I started to perform as a young person and realized that there was the chance to actually be educating my audience about the music that I loved, the music that I was privileged to perform, I found that this was a way that I could actually live my life as a performer who is an educator of my audiences, in effect. So that track allowed me to be very free and happy as a performer, because that part of my education background was really being fed all the way through my performing career. So adding full-time teaching to that in Houston really just enhanced that. So any opportunity I had, I would be involved in community engagement for the Houston Grand Opera and with the symphony, and Da Camera Society is one of their major chamber music presenters there as well. So locally, I was involved with all those organizations throughout the time I was resident at the University of Houston. So moving up here, I really looked immediately for opportunities to get connected to the Rochester community and was so moved to find how rich the community spirit is here. For being so much of a smaller community in terms of population, I realized that that had nothing to do with the richness of the institutions that are here to serve the community and the engagement of many, many people to foster more well-being and a community spirit among Rochesterians. So it was fun for me to start to discover the city in those ways and to see how rich the arts community is here. And one of the first things I was able to do was to get involved with an initiative of one of my new colleagues at Eastman, Carol Rodland, who founded in the year that she joined the faculty, which was the same year I did, in 2008. She founded a series of concerts that she called If Music Be the Food. And her goal was to partner with Rochester Food Link, which is the major food bank for not only Rochester, but the nine-county area that surrounds this community, and to find a way to have musicians serve this beneficial entity that is feeding people and taking care of marginal communities. So I wholeheartedly joined in on that effort and was soon in charge of curating part of the concert series. And one of the features of that was that it was community focused for not only the faculty, but for students. So all of our concerts featured faculty and students collaborating for the benefit of Rochester Food Link. So for the 10 years that I've been here, I've been involved in that every season, either as a performer or helping to curate my students performing and garnering a section of that series for the benefit of Rochester Food Link. I also had the opportunity when I first got here as a faculty member to participate in the Eastman Day of Service. And that's something that I was also gratified to see, that Eastman School of Music would get our students, our brand new students who hadn't yet started classes, and involve them in some aspect of community service during the orientation week. So I volunteered for that immediately and got in touch with the project that I was assigned to, which was the Gandhi House. And I started to get to know their work. I firsthand helped clear the part of their garden outside and was involved with helping to repair the house that they occupy over on Plymouth Avenue. And just found that that was such a valuable and needed aspect of community engagement, where nonviolent communication and upholding the principles that Gandhi spoke for and lived and died for are alive and well here and are serving the community. So those are two things that happened right off the bat for me that made my coming here feel like I had a foothold in community service of some kind, and also served to continue to educate me about what it means to be a privileged white person in our time and what responsibilities I have to continue to increase my own awareness of my privilege, my bias, and to increase my circle of effective communication and giving to my community.
Well, we have certainly felt the effects of your willingness to just jump into community engagement at Eastman, and that's something that we are very thankful for that you do at Eastman. And going back to your own education, you studied voice personally at Temple University and then at the Curtis Institute of Music. But you also have a Master's of Science in Medical Humanities from the University of Rochester. Could you talk a little bit about that degree and why you chose that course of study and how it relates to music?
That's a great question. During my career, I had a chance to travel so many places and be involved with communities across the country and truly internationally. But one particular community that I performed with frequently, actually, was Dallas in Texas, Dallas Opera. And in being involved with that company over several seasons, one of the board members is a medical doctor who happened to be the president of Southwestern Medical University, which is an enormous complex there. And in touring the facilities there at Southwestern, I just, something awoke in me and said, you know, musicians really have something incredibly important to offer the medical community in terms of the way that we have to keep our own health in check. And I'm thinking more particularly of singers, since our instrument is our body, and we can't pack it up into a case and, you know, transport it safely. We have to transport ourselves, and we have to be always attuned to the environment we're in. We have to be aware of our eating habits, our sleeping habits, our exercise habits, on and on. So my own discipline as a performer made me start to see that there were implications for the health of others that that my personal journey could maybe impact in a positive way. So this seed got planted decades ago, where I thought the medical community could potentially benefit in some way from me as an artist interfacing with their process. So fast forward to coming here, being a part of a magnificent university that has a prominent and very, very lively medical school, plus all of our medical facilities. So we are truly one of the great providers of medical practice through this region. I found that all of a sudden in reading the daily news brief that we get every day at Rochester, it's called, that there was an announcement of a new degree program that was being offered at the School of Medicine and Dentistry, and it was in the field of medical humanities. I'd never heard of it, never heard of medical humanities as a field, but sure enough, come to do a little investigation and realized that that field started almost at the same time that my initial impulse to participate in medical practice in some way happened. So I thought there was this interesting convergence, you know, of like-mindedness. And when I found out that this was a course of study that I could pursue here while I was still a faculty member at Eastman, and to add this to my activity for a concerted period of time, I jumped at it because I realized that this was something where it was something was taking shape and something was really speaking to a very deep place in my own heart about what my job, as I already mentioned, I see myself as an educator. And over time, I have also seen myself more broadly as a part of the healing community, that music is a healing force. My participation in music, my representation of a living entity, bringing music to life and engaging with audiences is a healing act. So this double sort of, if you will, double motivation really made me jump at seeing what this medical humanities degree was about. So as it turns out, it's a Master's of Science, as you mentioned. It's ostensibly a one-year full-time program, which I could never have managed with my full-time work at Eastman. So once again, I found a way to live a double life, and I took it on as a part-time student. So luckily, as an applied teacher at Eastman, I have some control over how I structure my days. And of course, I coordinate with my schedule with my students' schedules. So with a little bit of planning and a lot of love and compassion from my students who really were not aware of the fact that I was pursuing a course of academic study along with teaching them, I managed my schedule so that I could get to the classes. And I also structured my program, because this particular degree has a lot of flexibility, I structured my program so that I could do some things that really were meaningful to me. One of them was taking a class with Edward Deci, who is on the psychology faculty at the U of R, and he and Rich Ryan over the years have developed this unbelievably successful motivational strategy called the theory of intrinsic motivation. So I had a chance to take a class with him and to start to understand firsthand how one uses the intrinsic motivational energy that we all are born with and that we all respond to, whether we know it or not, and how one can channel that and improve the well-being of oneself, but also people that you interact with. So I was able, with this medical humanities degree, to fill a number of sort of bucket list areas of inquiry that I was particularly fascinated by. Another one was music cognition. And that is something that a number of our faculty at Eastman are very, very strongly involved in as researchers. And so I've always been fascinated by that phenomenon of what music does to us mentally and emotionally and how it facilitates our abilities to learn other subject matter, how it impacts our abilities to perceive sound in general, how we use sound. So I enjoyed having that. I brought that into my own course of study as part of my terminal project, my capstone project, which was to use musical skill sets to improve how physicians in their training to be medical doctors would interface with patients when they have a computer sitting in the clinical exam room. Of course, this is a rather new phenomenon, and it's one that patients have overwhelmingly found an intrusion and a distancing aspect to their contact with their physicians. So this just became a way that I thought that musicians, because we multitask, even though there are many people who disagree with even the concept of multitasking, we are very adept, let's put it that way, paying attention to not only the printed score in front of us, but also any of our collaborators that we may be making music with at a given moment. And I thought that this model of collaboration and synchronicity that we become experts in as musicians would serve to help medical students learn their craft of interviewing patients, paying attention to not only the verbal information that's being transmitted to them by their patients about their medical history or their condition, but also having an eye and an ear to how is that information being delivered and who is this person who's in this room with me. So I devised a little study module to potentially be incorporated into medical education as part of something that I would contribute to the good work that is being done in training our physicians. So there are things like that were just really very enlivening to me. One other aspect of it that I found very interesting was that I got a chance to do a major project about hearing impaired people and how they would be able to participate in cultural life with this impairment. And so it moved over to visual impairment, actually. And I did a project that resulted in a contribution that I've made to the Memorial Art Gallery in what is called an audio description. And what it is a particular way of describing a physical work of art. So I did a painting that hangs in the gallery. And I made a description of it, an oral verbal description that would be geared towards someone who couldn't actually see the artwork. And I researched the phenomenon of creating these kinds of audio descriptions as an ancillary to the headphone audio guide that many regular sighted people would take with them around a gallery of art and get more appreciation for the works of art that they were confronting. This is a very specific one because it actually helps you understand what is being depicted and how it's being depicted and orienting it for a person who cannot fully see the artwork in front of them. So this was a wonderful expansion of my own acuity and my own appreciation for visual art and a way that I could make a small contribution to helping people who couldn't really appreciate it with their own sight, but providing a detailed descriptive for them to understand the works of art that they were enjoying.
Well, that is really fascinating. I had no idea what that major entailed. So that's really, really interesting. And you said before that the seed, when you became really interested in this kind of information, was when you were also thinking about singers and how we are our instrument and we have to be so careful with ourselves. So how, if at all, have the knowledge and skills that you gained from this degree aided or bettered your teaching of voice specifically?
Well, it's a really good question, Ellen. And being a singer yourself, I'm sure this is something that we're all hungry for, is a knowledge of how we can apply information like this. The most practical application, of course, is the idea that as a musician and as a singer in particular, we deal with text. And there's so much in a given text, especially a poetic text, in terms of its form, in terms of the choice of words and what's there, what's not there, right? The things that are left out. And to find ways to be more attuned to how a text is constructed. And then how do wonderful composers set this text for us to interpret? So there's several layers of interpretation that go on in our work as singers. And so medical humanities, for example, was based on a deep, what they call a close reading of medical encounters. And this is one of the foundational pillars, if you will, of this whole inquiry as to how do medical professionals speak to one another. How do they write about their cases, as they call them? How do they write about their patients? So what we do as interpretive artists is that we glean information and then we see how we interface with the printed page, the music that we have, the text that we have. How do we intone that text? literally, how do we formulate the words? How do we formulate the syllables? How does the composer set this text? How do we then imbue part of our own personality and our own desire to communicate through this text? So my close reading protocols that I've learned in medical humanities have helped me strengthen and become more adept and more curious about how we deal with text as singers. So that's one small aspect of how I would say that I've actually literally learned a technique from my medical humanities training that I'm applying to singing directly. Obviously, the more general things of why do we do this, right? Why do we sing? What function does singing have, and more broadly, what function does music making have in the well-being of the music makers and the communities that are there to enjoy and participate in our music making? What's that circuitry that connects us to an audience? What is the special opportunity that we have to heal one another through this medium of art? And music more specifically, and singing more specifically than that. And I think both of us know that one of the things that first attracted us to singing was hearing sounds that we imitated, right? And whether that was the radio back in my day, or, you know, or recorded music that we saw, or, you know, hearing people perform in on television or in film, things that you're immediately drawn to. What is that? That is so exciting. That is so fun. I want to do it. And so I think that there's just an innate desire in us to communicate in ways that are not limited strictly by speech and by our cultural upbringing, but to explore other media, to explore other cultures through the ways that music transcends them.
Well, that's really interesting. And I know that there are many singers and musicians, such as Renee Fleming, for instance, who have been studying actively the voice and just music in general and how it affects our brain and how we perceive music and how we actually, you know, apply it to the page. So it's so good to know that that work is being done and that there's so much more research being done on that.
Indeed. I was so happy 2 years ago to actually participate in a weekend-long symposium that Renee sponsored with the National Institutes for Health down at the Kennedy Center in D.C. And at that time, there were numerous performances of varied kinds of performing arts organizations interfacing with scientists who had studied the cognitive aspects of it, plus the medical aspects of how does this enhance well-being to be making music, to be involved in music. So I laud and applaud Renee's engagement in this, and I feel like I'm sort of a part of her team, if you will, of artists who really feel so strongly that our purpose is certainly broader than thrilling the audiences that pay the high-priced tickets and are lucky enough to get to hear live performing. Our job is much grander, and our challenge in our current environment, where there is so much need, there is so much mental anguish and so many emotional issues that border on illness, that music has a place in really serving these communities and those of us who do it and who know how much it means to us and how it has promoted our own well-being. We can actively share that.
Well, that's just so encouraging to know that that's going on. And going back to just music making, and when you were talking about so many things that you've been involved in the community, not just in Rochester, but in so many different places, I'm wondering how then and now were you able to balance your own teaching and musical life with your personal life and this investment in the arts for the benefit of other people? You talked about that a little bit, but I'm just really curious to know about that.
Yeah, well, it's a question that I generally answer by saying I don't have a personal life, right? I'm one of these very all-in singers and musicians. So my hobbies are music. My altruistic endeavors are music-related whenever possible. So I just found that music became a medium in which I could be all of the aspects of my needs as a person. My relationships are so strongly based in people who are engaged in musical activity one way or another, or in teaching. And so I've never really separated them, to tell you the honest truth. I was always at a loss when someone said, "What are your hobbies?" It's like, I don't have hobbies. I just, music is all of that.
I know a lot of times when people ask me my hobbies too, I just think, I don't know of any. I don't have any hobbies.
Well, because music engulfs all of your, let's say, all of your leisure time reading, for example. You might even be reading, you know, a casual work of fiction. But what are you doing sort of behind the scenes as you're going, like, how would I portray that on stage? You know, there's always that part of our brains that are at work applying our knowledge and applying our experiences. You travel and you see something happen, you know, in the community that you're in, and you just go like, whoa, that could be an incredibly dramatic effect if we would do that on stage. You know, that, so there is just a part of our artistic brain that's always at work, and we're translating, and hopefully at some point we get to transmit the life experience that we've had, whether they're in music or outside of music. You start to realize that we can embody that. And our own mental and emotional health, and the ways that we've kept ourselves in a good state to be able to be musicians and to be able to continue to offer our voices as the medium, that whole experience is something that is also teachable and translatable to many, many different areas.
Right. And I knew this before, but I'm discovering even more now. You have so many stories to tell. I'm wondering if you could tell me a favorite story from a performance that you were involved in, such as an opera or a recital or a recording, just something that was funny or meaningful or just impactful for you in some way.
Well, you're right. There are so many. I'll just share an aspect of my singing career that was always rather special and a little bit crazy. I don't consider myself a daredevil kind of person in my real life. You know, I'm very cautious about making sure that I don't take unwarranted chances. However, as a musician, I'm not so restrained. And so one of the things that I always did as a professional was I would jump in and save performances where someone got sick at the last minute and they needed, you know, that 11th hour, somebody come and help us, you know, so that the show can happen. And so I guess one of the funnier ones was sitting in my apartment in New York and getting a phone call that the second replacement for Dalila in a production in Mexico had just pulled out. So the first person already had gotten sick and had pulled out. Then they called someone to replace that person, and that person got sick and couldn't do it. So they were at their absolute desperate last ditch. This was 48 hours before the performance. And it was in Monterrey. And all I had to do was to know that it was Samson and Dalila, one of my all-time favorite stories in opera, of course, the biblical story of Samson and Delilah. And luckily, I'd already learned Dalila's arias, which she has three magnificent arias. So that was like, okay, I'm already in love with this character. I already love the music. Then the thing that really made it, you know, the linchpin, if you will, was that the Samson was going to be Plácido Domingo. So I went, I'm doing this. I don't care whether it's 48 hours notice. So grab the score and start going and figuring out what the rest of the role entailed. And luckily, I speak French, so, you know, I wasn't totally off my rocker in thinking that I might be able to have a prayer of having this part somewhat learned in a two-day span. I packed for a different environment. I packed for a different altitude. Monterrey is a bit higher than sea level. And I packed all my wits about me, and I set about memorizing this role in a record amount of time, basically. So I get down to Mexico, and I find out that I arrive at the exact same time that everyone else is gathering to do this production. And I couldn't understand how this was possible. But apparently this was a production that was already in the repertory of the Monterrey Opera. And in seasons past, they had done Sanson y Dalila at another time. So the chorus actually knew their parts and knew, had some idea of staging even. My agent had neglected to tell them that I had never sung the role before. So that was probably so that they would actually hire me. Right. If they had said, well, she's just going to learn this part and do you a big old favor. And they'd probably go like, well, no, thanks. We'll, lump it and not do this performance or something. So here I arrive and Placido arrives at the same time I do from some place even much farther away than New York. I'm sure he was one of the incredible jet setter singers of all time. Had just a way of never suffering from jet lag for all that I could ever see of his singing and his collaboration. So he arrives, I arrive, the chorus is there, and they put me on stage with the chorus for the first scene. And they say, well, you know, just do what you normally do. And I'm going like, well, why don't you tell me a little bit about what you normally do in the staging of this scene? And so that's how I managed to find out what their staging was like. And I invented my own staging for a large portion of this production. So we're down to now day before the show and had a nice little musical rehearsal at Mr. Domingo's apartment where he was helping to conduct the rehearsal. I mean, because as many of you know, that he's such a fine, fine musician that this was something he sort of took in stride long before he actually stood on the podium of his many opera houses in more recent years. So here we were in, you know, all together, just singing through parts of it, you know, having what the Germans would call a Verständigungsprobe, which is basically just everybody, you know, puts their time in and says, okay, we're going to take this tempo and we're going to breathe here. And, you know, they just kind of shortcut their way through the score. Meanwhile, I have yet to sing this full score. Gulp. Okay, so I've got it in my brain. I have a roadmap of where I'm going to be. I've had the costume fitting where they've pasted me into into my seductive costume. I arrive at the theater for the first performance. And there's this enormous tractor trailer truck sitting out in back of the theater. And I go, what is this? And they said, oh, it's the television crew because it's going to be nationally televised. And I went, oh, God. I take another big gulp. I walk into the theater, get into my makeup and my costume and my wig. And I realize that my first essay of this opera is going to be televised nationally to the country of Mexico. Then they were going to interview me at the intermission. So I said, good. Because then I said, and I'm singing this opera for the very, very first time. And so I tried to explain a little bit of the fact that I was, you know, an 11th hour replacement and just tried to, you know, give a little context in this interview to let them know that I was really, you know, kind of hanging out on a very, very thin limb in portraying this iconic character for a national televised production. So it was exciting, as one could imagine, but it was also just hair-raising, especially because I knew that there was going to be this broader public than just the, you know, just the theater audience. And years later, when I sang with Placido at the Met, I was singing a pants role at that time, which was the antithesis of, as you can imagine, the antithesis of being this femme fatale of Dalila. So I chose not to mention to him that I had actually performed with him years before in this crazy production in Monterrey. Well, sure enough, one of his buddies came to him at one of the performances that we were doing. This was Tales of Hoffman at the Met. And brought him some pictures. He said, do you know that you've actually performed with this person before? Because I was Niklaus to his Hoffman. So I was his sidekick throughout the whole production, you know, trying to save him from his terrible fate as a poet, falling in love with all the wrong women. And I was his muse, and I was trying to keep him a little bit safe. So he goes backstage after one of the shows and just said, I think that I have performed with you somewhere before. And he pulled out some production photos from this production in Monterrey years before. And I lost it. I just had such a laugh about it because here he was trying to put the picture of this woman who, you know, had seduced him on stage, and trying to put that picture next to this kid who was, you know, dressed in a jacket and portraying a young man. He was trying to put the two of us together and realize that we were one in the same person. So anyway, it was very, very funny. And it had a wonderful collegial outcome because he realized that, you know, that I was kind of that daredevil in disguise. And I was also a very successful portrayer of a very different kind of role at another time and place. So it was just a really very rich encounter altogether, but kind of one of the more insane things that I've done in my life.
What an experience. I cannot even imagine. Oh, my gosh. And, you know, speaking of funny stories, I understand that there is another especially funny story about the time that you went to see the movie Manchester by the Sea. Could you talk about that a little bit?
I could. Oh, my gosh. Well, this movie came out just 2 years ago or 3 years ago now, I guess, around Christmas time. And I heard from two of my colleagues at Eastman. They said, you should see this movie. And they just sort of said it like very suggestively, you should see this movie. I'm going like, okay, I'll go see this movie. And so I had found out that, unbeknownst to me, that my voice was being used, my singing voice was featured on the soundtrack of Manchester by the Sea. And it was featured in a performance of Handel's Messiah that I had recorded ages ago. In fact, this will date it for some of your listeners. It was the first digital recording of Handel's Messiah that was made. And it was made by Richard Westenberg and Musica Sacro, a magnificent ensemble, a New York-based ensemble, who would perform Messiah every year at Avery Fisher Hall, or Alice Tully, Avery Fisher. I never performed it with them. That's why I don't remember which hall it was at. That's another part of the funny story. But I was hired to sing this recorded performance for RCA of Messiah. Of course, we did it at a very non-Christmas time of year. And it was just a magnificent experience to be a part of that recording. So years later, someone decided to use portions of this recording as part of the soundtrack. And because I, as a recording artist, was paid at the moment that I recorded it, I didn't have any residual rights, or I had no control or knowledge of what had happened to that, you know, to the rights for that recording along the way. And sure enough, they were sold to Sony and they were excerpted for this particular film. So I ended up taking some very, very close people to be here in Rochester. I took them to the showing of the film, not knowing exactly where and when my voice would show up in this film. And it turned out that it showed up at a very poignant moment in a very, very tragic film. So it actually was a moment of, you know, high emotional intensity. And so I lost it listening to, you know, to that in context of the film. And the people that I was closest to were just overwhelmed by the fact that my voice had a part in this film that was nominated for an Oscar. And so it had a pretty strong showing as an artistic product as well. So you never know.
Well, what a way to find out that you're featured on a movie soundtrack. I mean, surprise, yes. Literally.
Truly.
And while we're on the subject of your recordings, I have been very excited to talk to you about the Grammy that you recently won. Congratulations. That is such a huge honor.
Oh, indeed. And for a project that was just not, you could not imagine that this would come out to be a Grammy nominee, let alone a winner. This was a live performance that was done in Houston with the Houston Symphony. This was Best Opera Recording. And we did it as a concert, sort of semi-staged concert performance for two performances. And the sound engineer, since I lived in Houston for so long, I mean, I knew the sound engineer is a good friend of mine, and the conductor, Hans Graf, who knew the score inside and out. He was such a masterful conductor of this particular score of Wozzeck by Alban Berg. And it was part of his farewell to the symphony because he had been music director for many years. And he desperately wanted to do this as a special project. So here we are doing our live performances for the concert going public there. It was recorded, obviously, for further broadcast, radio broadcast. And yet the recordings turned out to be good enough that over a period of a number of years, the recording engineer and Hans Graf worked together to craft a CD worthy of publication on its own. So we had no retakes. We did not do any of what you would normally do in a recording circumstance where you break the piece apart into small segments and you record each of them individually and you paste it together and edit it very, very thoroughly. This was done with editing of a live performance. And for some magnificent reason, it excelled as a recorded entity, and it garnered this incredible prize. We were just beyond thrilled.
Well, that is amazing. And, you know, I'm also curious as to know what has been the outcome of winning this award, and how has this impacted your career, particularly as a woman in music?
Well, good point. Well, the woman that I portray in the show is, you know, she's sort of a lowlife. She's a neighbor of the protagonist, Marie. She's, you know, a bar fly, if you will. She's not an upstanding citizen in any normal sense of the word, I guess you could say. So it just goes to show that the stories that we portray have impact and a purpose way beyond, you know, reflecting anything of our own personal nature in them. I had a ball portraying this person, to tell you the honest truth. It was very, very fun. In terms of a career, at this stage of my career, I mean, I'm not performing full time. I really do things just for fun, if anything, right now at my tender age. And I have no regrets. I mean, I just feel that I was so fortunate to be active in so many areas of classical performing, but with symphony orchestra engagements and opera engagements and televised engagements and radio productions and recordings. This Grammy for me is really sort of a crowning achievement, to just feel that in a recorded medium, which was never something that I ever took to as an artist. I envy people like Renee, for example, for her capacity to be such a successful and such an immensely prolific recording artist. Many of my recordings were these odd one-off things, or something like my recording of the title role of Mark Blitzstein's Regina, where again, I was filling in for someone who couldn't do the recording. I didn't do the live stage production that accompanied this recording, for example. I was singing in another country, another production at the same time that this recording was being made. I mean, there's just this, my crazy stories about recordings are kind of there's a stuff of fairy tales in a certain sense as to how they ever came out well. So this recording had a similarly unusual sort of journey to greatness. And so I personally just take it as just an incredible gift from the gods, if you will, to crown a long career of adventures and just incredible investment of my own learning as a performing artist. I mean, I'm a lifelong learner in so many aspects of my life, and this is just another aspect of it that I feel so rewarded that this came to fruition, and that it really honored Hans's work with the symphony. It honored the Houston Symphony for being the premier ensemble that they are. Having lived there for so many years, I just knew and cherished so many of the members of the orchestra, and having them win this, their first Grammy, was really just a collective hooray for everyone. So it's meaningful in that way, in sort of a collaborative sense as well.
What is most exciting about music to you now?
Well, teaching is the first thing that pops to my mouth. I get a chance to share what I love and my passion for making music. It's ever fresh to me. So what I love about music is still the discovery process. There's always a new way to interpret a text. There's always a new way to shape a phrase. There's always new musical energies to see embody something. Right now, you know, so many of my students are singing pieces that I've had intimate knowledge of. And so, for example, a Mozart concert aria that one of my students is going to perform on a master's recital. I have intimate knowledge of this piece. I performed it as a young student as well, almost at the same age as when I first came to know it. So I have that kind of like deja vu about, you know, seeing someone of a similar vintage explore this work for the first time and realize its history, and to have an opportunity to bring it to life and to share its particular glories with an audience. So there's always that transferal of my own discovery process that now I get to share with my students and others at Eastman that really enrich, that continue to enrich my life as I give it, you know, pay it forward, if you will, and let those works really live and imbue them with a sense of passion and artistic excellence. So it's life-giving on both ends.
Well, before we go, do you have any advice to share with young musicians, specifically singers or young women in music? Just any advice for them?
Well, I love the fact that you're including the day we're actually doing this interview happens to be International Women's Day.
Yes.
And so I received a text message from someone who studied with me recently, and she's in Portugal, and she sent me a text message and just said, I have to send this message to you because you are such an incredible woman in music. So I'm just coming over here. I got that message from her, and I just feel so excited about that. As singers in particular, we're so lucky because we have a place in music and music making that is not subject to, you know, the gender issues. I perform music that obviously the countertenors can perform, and there are many sort of gender-bending things about my own involvement in stage portrayals. I think women have such a powerful, literal place in vocal music. And more broadly, women are finally being recognized as composers, as conductors, as stage directors, and you know, involving all those other aspects of production and creation, creativity for the stage. So I'm heartened to be part of a generation that sees that really blossoming. I feel that any of us who enter music at this point in time, in our country in particular, we see the issues, the economic issues that surround making art in our country, and we see that there is still, as strong as ever, there is still an urge to do that. There's still a need to do that. Our institutions will continue to change. They have to, because so many of them have been ossified in certain ways, and particularly in terms of diversity. They have existed as sort of pillars of the establishment. They became financially beholden to members of the quote-unquote establishment, and they became answerable to people whose taste was formed in a very narrow body of what was considered excellent music or the best music. So we have this dead white guy, you know, mentality that has pervaded classical music for my lifetime, certainly, and several generations prior to that. So the fact that now we have the opportunity to literally uncover and to bring to the stage music of a much wider, divergent source, and to really speak to communities that have a rich cultural heritage that some of our performing institutions haven't even begun to touch. To me, that's one of the great joys and great purposes that young musicians now will serve. It's to continually enrich and expand what is considered classical music, what is considered the music that is necessary to be heard at this time, what are the communities that need to hear this music performed by the best musicians possible, how do we train them, how do we bring them to the height of their own capacities in their skills. These are the questions, and these are the opportunities for the musicians of our time.
Well, and you are certainly a figure that we, as the next generation of music makers, are looking up to in paving that way and making a way for new music, new composers, new musicians. So thank you so much for being here today, Professor Chasinski. It was such a pleasure to speak with you and to give our listeners the chance to learn a little bit more about you.
It is great, great pleasure for me. I'm so grateful to you for the invitation. This was a really enjoyable and hopefully a very enlivening moment for your listeners as well.
Well, absolutely. Thank you.